Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 104, recorded March 12, 2012.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
Can you hear me that far away? I guess they can.
It's showing up.
That's good. That's good.
Okay, I'm going to take a seat here. We just put our computer back together after a week of...
It was at the the overpriced computer doctor, I might add.
Yeah.
A bit not completely satisfied.
So let's hope this works.
Yeah.
But it seems to be so far, so we're going to go with it. So who are we hearing from today?
We are hearing from Andreka in Oregon and Carlos in New York, Jackson in Australia, Ken Jones of Prince of Palms, Cliff in Michigan, Sam J., who's a new contributor. We don't know where he's from, though. Tony, New York, Nathan in Salisbury, England, who's also new, and Mick in Carnforth.
Cool. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. We have a lot of people, as you just heard, which is exciting. We're glad. It's fun. So our first question is from...
Andreka.
Okay.
She sent us a question on Facebook.
Yeah, about fish food. How quickly fish food can go bad.
Mm-hmm.
Or how...
How do you know if your fish food is expired?
It's too old, yeah. Yeah, basically. And my rule of thumb is to try to use it within 3 months. But 6 months isn't too bad either. And some people go a little longer. But the nutrients, you know, as soon as you open it up, the container, and it starts being exposed to oxygen, you're going to start losing nutrients gradually. So my rule of thumb is to try to finish in 3 months. And I know that there are people who aren't as paranoid about it as I am, but that's usually what I go with.
And so it's usually a better idea to buy fish food in as small a container as will suit your needs.
Right. It may be cheaper to buy a large one, but if you take 2 years to finish the large one, the food you're giving them at the end of those 2 years is not as nutritious as the food you're giving them the first few months.
Or if you throw away a mostly full container at 6 months, it's not cheaper anymore.
Right. So that's what I usually try to do. There are things you can do to help. One thing, the oxygen does damage the food, and so making sure it's tightly closed, getting a brand of food that has a lid that tightly closes, that helps. Also, avoiding humidity inside the food. You know, you don't
keep it in the fridge?
You can. A lot of people do, and that will help preserve the nutrients too. But then the thing is, if you keep it in the fridge and then you leave it out even once, and then the moisture in the air can condense inside there,
and it gets moldy.
That ruins it. So, yeah. So if you keep it in the fridge and just keep it there all the time,
who never forgets anything. Go ahead and keep it in the fridge.
Yeah. Or if you just keep it in the fridge all the time and just take out enough to feed them with and put it in a separate container and then go feed everybody.
Oh yeah, I guess you can.
You can do that. And I've done that with certain foods too. I did that with some really expensive golden pearls, and then one day I left them on top of my fish tank for 2 hours.
Oh, sadness. Upset about that.
Anyway, so, yeah, that's the long and the short of it, I guess, for fish food.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your question, Andreka.
Yes.
Carlos posted a picture on Facebook.
And you got to give him the background here.
Okay, because we'd been talking about double-tailed betas. And I mentioned, at least the ones that I had seen, their tail, it just looked like a butt. It looks like a single tail coming out in the shape of a bee, and it just looked like a butt. It was like plumber's crack on a fish, and I just did not like them. And so Carlos said, no, you have to see a picture of a really good one, because all I'd seen were, you know, the pet store ones, which are obviously culls.
At least a lot of them are.
Yeah. So he sent a picture to Facebook of a really nice one, which I thought was very interesting. Looks like a completely different tail mutation than what we'd seen in the pet store. Because the one that Carlos sent, it looks like there are two separate tails that just kind of overlap. Like, you could see the gap in between them near the...
caudal peduncle?
Yes, thank you. So they were two different tails coming off of the body that just overlapped. Whereas the ones in the pet store looked like it was a single tail that flared out and was in the shape of a bee. Bee for butt.
Now, I may be wrong about this, but it seems like the breed standard calls for two separate tails. But I could be wrong. But someone who, Carlos or someone else who knows the breed standard for bettas, for double tails, can tell us whether or not the lobes have to be completely separate in order to count for a show fish or not. That would be interesting to know. But, see, here's the upshot of this. Kelly thought the fish looked nice.
Yeah, he looked nice. If that's what a double tail actually is, then I like them. I don't like the butt fish.
Okay.
And I'll stop saying butt now, I'm sorry.
Okay. Thanks, Carlos. It is a beautiful fish.
Yes. Okay, we have a question from Jackson in Australia. And Russ is going to fill us in on the background of his question, just to refresh everybody's memory, because it kind of carries over from a previous episode.
Yeah, basically Jackson had been asking earlier, he had this 20-gallon tank, and he was wondering what he could breed in the 20-gallon tank. Not guppies or mollies, I guess he's done that and wants to move on to something different, which, you know, I can understand that. So he wants to do something in there that he can breed, but he had these two catfish in the tank, and he said the catfish were pretty small, pretty shy and retiring. They stayed hidden a lot of the time. But I said it might be a good idea just to see if you can find out what the catfish are, because catfish can be deceiving, basically. So he did a little research, and he's going to tell us what he thinks he's got in there so that we can know what to advise him about what might possibly breed in the tank.
And he says he thinks that he has two different kinds of catfish. One is a feather fin synodontis, and one is an Asian bumblebee catfish. So, he also says, with some research, I think that these will be inadequate for breeding. Could you suggest some entertaining fish that could go in this tank?
Right, and I agree with you, Jackson. I don't think you'll be able to do a whole lot of breeding anything in that tank with those catfish in there.
Now tell us why.
Well, and I'm not going to say it's entirely impossible, but it's not going to be ideal.
Fruitful, far like from he ideal. Wants.
Right. So, well, the thing about synodontis is that quite a bit of them, quite a few of them, there are a lot of synodontis out there, but quite a few of them are predatory.
Okay.
Some of them
so
live
with
gonna
eat the babies.
Fish in the rift lakes in Africa, where they go around at night slurping up baby mbunas and stuff,
you know,
that sort of thing. So that can be bad. The kind that you have, if it's a feather fin, which is also called a squeaker cat.
Does it squeak?
I believe they do. A lot of fish make noises. People don't realize that, but they do. Okay. And they can get big, like 8 inches long. Well, that's like 20 centimeters for those of you who have gone over to the more intuitive metric system. Over 20 centimeters. It's a big fish for a 20-gallon tank. And it's a big fish for wanting to breed anything in there with it. I mean,
because it's going
to
eat everything.
Yeah,
right?
And not only that, they can be grumpily territorial.
That's a great phrase.
Isn't it? Though I like that.
You should like kinda copyright it or
something. Sort of a little
thing.
It's
a band name.
Phrase. Grumpily territorial.
Yeah, maybe it's more of an album.
Now
maybe.
Opening for the feather fins. So I would say, actually, a 20-gallon is not going to be a very good permanent home for a feather fin. So if you're certain that's what
whether
you've got.
Whether you're breeding or not.
Yeah, whether you're breeding or not, you're going to need a bigger tank, at least twice that size, really, for a fish that's going to get that big. They do live a long time. They can live to be 15 more or more years old. So
wow.
You could have an interesting pet, but not with really small fish, because they'll probably get eaten, and not in that tank, because the tank's a little small for the adult size. If, you know, and it's possible. I mean, you can look at some other synodontis and make certain that's what you got, but if it is, that's what I would say. If it's an Asian bumblebee catfish, tank mates also have to be fairly large, because
he thinks he's got both of these, one of each?
Yeah, one of each. And an Asian bumblebee catfish, I mean, they get fairly big too, but they also have huge mouths, a big gape. They are very predatory. And so they can eat fish that are pretty large in proportion to their body size, because they've got a huge mouth.
Would you eat the synodontis one?
Probably not. I mean, it depends on their relative sizes, but you're probably safe there. But what I'm hoping, because a 20-gallon is kind of pushing it even for one of those. So if it is an Asian bumblebee, that's not really very good news. If it's a South American bumblebee catfish, which are hard to tell apart. So you can look at do a little bit more research, but one of them, and I can't actually recall which one it is, they have a spot near their tail. One of them is a triangular shape and one of them is more round, and that can help you tell it apart.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could remember which one is which. Also, the South American bumblebee has a bigger, or a smaller mouth, with a less of a gape. So they will eat fish that are small enough for them to swallow, but they just can't swallow fish that are anywhere near as big. So that's about where we are. If you do have a South American bumblebee, which we kind of hope you do, that would be fine in 20 gallons. But it'll still eat whatever it can fit in its mouth, so probably not a whole lot of breeding so going on in that tank unless you do some maneuvering, moving things around.
Fish.
Yeah.
Now, you had an idea for him in case he wanted to not follow through on the breeding idea and just put something else in for fun.
Yeah, because he was thinking about doing that. And I figured if he does find new homes for the catfish, a beta sorority is kind of fun. You could probably keep 8 or 9 bettas in there. Female bettas, of course.
It's not your everyday average tank, either
right.
With mollies or guppies. So.
And it's brightly colored. It's not you're not going to do any breeding in there, but they're very interesting to watch. They're very interactive with each other and with you. They notice you and so on, so that's kind of fun. We're doing a beta sorority in a 20-gallon with also some guppies and a couple other things in there, and it's really interesting to watch. So, you know, you could consider that if you do find different homes for those catfish. All right, now I got to do this because I'm not sure Kelly's going to let me. Because Ken Jones, Prince of Ponds, and Cliff from Michigan also sent us some comments that are related to each other, and they're about Kelly, because last episode, you may recall, she wasn't here the whole time. And
was it last episode? Or
not last episode.
That?
It was episode 102. And speaking of Kelly, both of them had some good things to mention, which I think are good to mention, because might as well give credit where credit is due. I think that's a good idea. Ken, the Prince of Ponds, said, Kelly is perky, plucky, quirky, and smart. Definitely the frosting on the cake. And we like you too, Russ. And you can quote me on that. You can quote me on the show on that, so there. And I think it's true. You add
Thank
all
you
of those things
much.
And more to the show. And Cliff said that he had been offline for a bit with no desktop and just went through all the episodes from mid-December on. And he has to say that after listening to episode 102, that Kelly definitely adds to the show. Russ has good fish knowledge, but Kelly gives you someone to work off of. I personally like how well the two of you complement each other.
Well, thank you very much, both
so
of you.
So thanks to Ken and Cliff. I
That's
agree.
That's very nice of you.
I agree. Good stuff. Okay. See, she wouldn't have let me say that, so I had to say it all. Okay.
Okay, we have some water questions from Sam J, who's a new contributor. So welcome to Sam.
Yeah, welcome, Sam.
He says, I'm a fairly new listener and love the show. I have two kind of related questions. The first is about pH. I know certain fish are supposed to need certain pH, but what really happens if it is not correct? I ask this because a friend gave me three juvenile discus, which I understand are supposed to have rather acidic water, yet mine is in the low 8s and they appear to be doing quite well.
Okay, that's a little bit of a complex question, but I think it's a great one to ask, and I'll see what I can do for you there. Well, pH. If you avoid extremes in pH, and you avoid fluctuations in pH, then many fish, especially captive bred fish, can really do well in a water
kind
of a
of
pH.
Adjust.
Yeah, as long as it's stable. And it's not crazy. You know, you don't want to keep discus.
It's not roller coastering.
Right. That's really important, not to roller coaster. But it's also important, and it's not too extreme. I mean, you don't want to try to keep most fish in water that's, you know, 5.8 or something, which is really acidic, or you don't want to try to keep them in 8.7, you know, most fish. There are some fish that can handle that. But if you keep your fish around, you got the low 8, so maybe you have 8.1, 8.2, something like that, and your discus are doing okay. Now, that's not too surprising as long as you're keeping that fairly stable. And that is quite a bit different from water than people usually associate with keeping discus, because the water they usually keep discus in is low mineral content and is on the acid side. But extremes and fluctuations with pH can wreak havoc. And part of it is because the higher the pH, the more toxic the ammonia, it becomes ammonia as opposed to ammonium. When low pHs, it's ammonium. We talked about this with a little while ago in another episode, not too long ago. Basically, that toxicity changes, and so you may have a fish in acid water, and suddenly you change it the pH goes up, and so does the toxicity of the ammonia.
Mm.
And so that can be bad. Something that Brian in Idaho has mentioned is pH burn.
Sounds
if,
painful.
If the pH changes too quickly, it can actually just, it attacks the tissues of the fish, including their gill tissues, but also their skin tissues,
swimming through
their fins.
Bleach or something.
Yeah, it's quite bad news. So there are things like that. Those are some of the extreme things that can happen that can cause extreme stress and death to fish if you get those extremes and fluctuations. Coloration can be affected too. I mean, I've noticed keeping neons in fairly water with a fairly high pH and then switching them to water carefully and gradually, of course, switching them to water with a fairly low pH, seeing how much redder their reds are and bluer their blues are and so on. So there are things like that. Or if you try to keep mbunas in really, water with a low pH, it's not good for them. They need water with a really, really high pH to be really healthy, and their color reflects that. So you can get better color with pH that is close to the range that the fish require. However, there are exceptions to this idea that fish can do fairly well in pH that is not what they're naturally used to, as long as it's gradual and stable. Like breeding. There are some fish that just can't breed in water that is too different from their natural pH. That has a lot to do with the viability of the eggs in that water. There
well,
are
that
cichlids,
makes sense. I mean, you can kind of survive in less than optimal conditions, but you might not be at your best to be reproducing.
Right. And there are certain sensitivities in the eggs and the fertilization process and so on that make it difficult for certain species to be able to lay eggs that are viable in water of the wrong pH. So although discus might do pretty well in water with a high pH, they probably won't have viable offspring in water like that. And that's why people usually use at least some RO water when they're breeding discus, or some other water of that sort.
And that brings the pH down.
Right, because RO water doesn't have a whole lot in it, so the lack of alkalinity in the water allows it to be closer to acid, and allows it, to, if you have acids in the water and so on, it goes down, and you can dilute the high levels of chemical materials in the water that make the pH high. And so there you go. Hopefully that helps give an idea with that.
Okay, his second question is about water softeners. He says, the house I bought a few years ago has a whole house softener. I was wondering if this is good, bad, or indifferent as far as aquariums go in general. I've been using the softened water without any issues, but was just curious about it. I've not been able to find any info about softeners concerning aquariums anywhere on the web, and was hoping you could shed some light on this for me.
Okay. Well, first of all, the idea behind most softeners... Oh, I like this. Look what he says, though. He says, make it row, R-O-E.
He's quoting Jean-Luc Cousteau.
Jean-Luc Cousteau. I like that.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, the idea here is that most water softeners... The classic water softeners you think of, anyway, work by trapping calcium and magnesium ions by exchanging them with sodium ions. That's why you get water softener salt, and you put all the water softener salt in there, so there's something for the ions to exchange. And that's good for reducing the hard water stains in your bathtub, but it's not necessarily good for your fish. Now, it won't necessarily kill your fish, and it depends, somewhat on the fish that you're keeping, but the ions that the fish are likely to encounter in water in the wild are not very close to what you get coming out of a softener. And things like calcium, magnesium, we know fish need those. They do need sodium too, but they're getting a lot more sodium with water from a water softener than they're used to, and not
so
enough.
Do you end
of some
up
with
fish
with
hypertension?
You know, that's a good question. I've heard of people who do it and their fish seem to survive, but a lot of aquarists prefer not to, probably because it's just that's not a natural proportion of ion concentrations for them, so it seems logical that it's probably not that good
not
for them
the
because
best
of that.
Thing, yeah.
And certain fish are really sensitive to sodium in the water. They really don't like it at all, and it can be bad for them, like some of the fish that like soft acid water. Some of those really don't tolerate salt all that well. And on the other hand, there are certain ways to soften the water, certain resins and so on that can pull things out of the water and collect them, and then in there, and then you can get rid of those and replace those resins. And those can draw things out of the water without really putting a whole lot back in. And
so it might kind of depend on what kind of system he's got.
Right. Some of the tap water filters that are sold for aquarium use work on that premise, and they do soften the water. So if you're using something like that, that can be expensive, but it can work fairly well. You don't want to have absolutely pure water, because that's not good for fish either. That's why when you keep discus, for example, in water that has gone through a reverse osmosis system, you have to add some mineral content back to the water, either by adding some equilibrium-type salts, you know, that are made to do that, or you can add a little bit more tap water. So maybe you have 3/4 of your water is RO water and 1/4 of it is your tap water. So it only has 25%
of the... It's got a little bit.
Yeah, of what it used to have in it, kind of idea. Approximately.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax.
So thank you, Sam, for your questions, and hopefully that clears up a few issues for you.
Yeah, I hope I'm not clipping. I'm kind of worried that I am. I'm trying to check the readout. Sorry, folks. Yeah, I'm trying to figure this out.
We're still kind of getting used to the new mic, so...
Yeah, so hopefully I'm not clipping. I'll try not to clip.
Well, just don't be around any coupons. Sorry. I'm bad. Okay. Okay, we have something from Tony in New York. And he says, although I don't have a tank in my basement, I think sometimes that I'd love to have one down here someday. Trouble is that standing water in my toilet bowl seems to promote mold growth. As a result, I'm not sure that an aquarium is a great idea, but I wanted to see what you thought. For example, if the tank was reasonably airtight, would this head off a problem? Alternatively, would any species considered the mold a delicacy? Or maybe the solution is just to clean the tank often. My basement is waterproofed, but apparently the protection is not perfect. Do you or any of your listeners have advice on such a situation? Thanks for the new unshower-like podcast.
You know, I'm glad he said that. And I think Jackson said something like that, too.
Yeah, I believe he did. He said the sound sounded better.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says, luckily you are out of the shower.
Right. So several of you have mentioned that, and we are glad to hear it. Mm. We're glad our investment was a good one.
So he's worried that if he puts a tank in his basement, it will promote mold growth in the basement itself, like basement walls and...
Well, that's what I'm kind of wondering if that's what he means. Maybe. See, one problem is that you're talking to people who live in the second driest state in the entire U.S.
I know.
It's a very, very dry state.
It's very dry. Hawaii was not very dry, though. So, I mean, Hawaii doesn't even have basements because the water table is so high they would just flood. You can't have a basement in Hawaii.
Not to mention that it would be entirely full of mold within about 72 hours.
Yeah.
The idea, Hawaii, it was so humid it didn't matter what we did. Because we weren't adding to the humidity.
You sit still for 5 minutes and you've got mold growing on you.
They don't tell you that in the tourist magazines, do they?
They don't tell you a lot of things. We won't go there.
No, but the basic idea is we've lived in two extremes in our fish keeping
lives.
Really dry
and really wet.
Yeah, and so it's hard to tell. I'm not sure what we can tell you.
I'm wondering what, you know, just air circulation-wise, what... that's like in his basement. He's in New York, so I mean, obviously he's on the coast. He's going to be a lot more humid than we are
right
here.
So I would like
to... Are there windows in the basement? Are there, you know, heater vents or air conditioning vents circulating any air through there? Is it totally...
Is it more...
You know, air circulation-wise, is it cut off from the rest of the house?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm wondering about that. And wondering maybe if people out there can tell us what you think.
Maybe you New Yorkers out there.
Or other people who live in more humid climates than us, which isn't hard, because unless you're in Nevada,
unless you live in Nevada, you are in a more humid climate than us.
And there are microclimates in the different parts of the states that are drier than we are here in places like Arizona and stuff.
It's drier here.
It is the second driest state in the U.S.
Just ask my knuckles every winter when they crack and bleed. It's drier here.
Yes, it is very dry here, so it's difficult to say. But we would just a couple of thoughts that I have, but I'd like to open this up to those of you who do live in more humid climates. But the aquarium water is going to be a significantly different environment than the toilet bowl, of course, in a lot of ways.
And I hope so.
Yes. But for one thing, it circulates more, and that's going to make a difference. And circulates in a different way. It's not just water coming down at certain times and so on. And there are competitors for nutrients in there. A lot of bacteria and fish and so on, plants that are going to be competing for nutrients.
So mold is not the only
thing growing. Right. And so it might just be outcompeted. I don't know. Although I have found mold sometimes if, like, when I'm feeding the fish, I get a little bit on the lower part of the glass cover and I don't notice. And then I come back and I notice later, a day or two later, that I missed some fish food and got it stuck on the bottom of the lid, and then it molds there. And I have to go get a paper towel or something and wipe it off. That has happened inside the tank because it's very humid there, obviously, much more humid than it is in the rest of the house. But it doesn't, I've never had a problem with it being in the water. So maybe what you're talking about is the cover.
He's not so worried about mold in the water of the tank, but the humidity, extra humidity from the tank promoting mold growth in the basement, house. In the house.
Well, I could see that being a problem. I have noticed that I've heard of people keeping tanks where they say even metal will rust in a room that has several tanks in it more readily, which I don't notice here because nothing rusts very well indoors anyway. But in Hawaii, everything rusted.
You've been enjoying the podcast for about 6 months
anyways,
now.
Even if we didn't.
He says, I found your show after we introduced a business from our home. Yeah. We've had a great deal of interest.
I guess we'll just
this business
have to
has
hope
transformed
that
me back into being a keen tropical fish enthusiast, having kept a small tank as a child. I have a small 100-liter tank for my hobby fish. Now I have the bug. I feel I will have marine setups.
We'll just have to live somewhere more humid.
I did email with a question. When you have clear seals on the inside joints of the tank, what is the best way to clean these as algae settles at these points? I normally use a sponge or a small brush, but it takes a lot of elbow grease. I wondered if you have a secret trick of the trade. Many thanks, Nathan.
Well, welcome, Nathan. I think that's cool that he's got a fish pedicure business.
Okay, I have to tell you this. We were driving around earlier today, and Russ was filling me in on a few things we were going to talk about for the podcast tonight, and he mentioned this fish pedicure business, and I just, my brain was not functioning, and I was thinking, what, you paint their fins? I don't get it. How do you give a fish a pedicure? They don't have any toes. And he's looking at me like, Kelly, you have lost it.
I was just a little bit worried that she was driving at the moment. Maybe that's all it was. You were just driving, and so it's hard to concentrate.
Driving and four screaming kids in the back of the car, bringing up fish toenail polish.
Well, yeah, but that's really cool. I mean,
what he really means.
Yeah.
Which we actually talked about before, so I should have remembered, but I didn't, obviously. Is you stick your own little tootsies in the water and the fish come up and nibble at them and eat off all your dead skin.
They help you exfoliate.
Yeah.
And things like that. There are probably garas, I'm guessing. Gara pingi pingi or something like that.
Pingi pingi. See, that sounds like something that would eat your feet.
There are a couple of different species out there, I guess, that they use, but it's probably something like that, which I think that's pretty cool. Have a business like that.
That is pretty cool.
Now, the question about the seals, like the silicone seals on the inside joints of the tank. Algae certainly does settle there. A couple of different things. One, after listening to your message, I started looking around to see what state the silicone was in various tanks in the house. Because I honestly don't usually keep them free of algae. I let a little algae settle there, I guess. I just was wondering.
Well, you've got so many bristle noses around, you just figured to leave them a snack.
And the bristle noses, I think algae crews are a partial answer because they will certainly keep it down. They will not eliminate it completely. One of the reasons they can't eliminate it completely is because the algae will eventually creep under the seals because water begins to creep under the seals just really slowly and gradually, but it gets under there. And when it does, the algae can get there, and then almost nothing can get rid of that. Short of, you know, cutting it all out with a razor blade and resealing the whole tank, which
probably doesn't most sound of us very fun.
Don't want to do. One thing, too, I was wondering about this, but I think it's possible that using a brush or something like that might actually abrade the surface of the silicone and make it have more surface area available for the algae, because you might have, you know, more pockets and so on where algae can get, where algae crew couldn't come along and scrape it off.
Would it eventually kind of degrade the actual seal?
I think it would take a long time to do that.
Just kind of scuff up the surface of it enough for there to be more surface area for the algae.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether it would do that or not. I'm not sure. It seems like it might do that after a while. But I would also like to open this out to those of you who have found good ways of keeping that clean, because, you know, it is hard to do. And I usually just let a little bit go there, and it doesn't really cause a huge problem. But if you want to get rid of it, there's got to be a way to do it. So do any of you know secret tricks for doing that? That sounds like it could be a useful thing to be able to do. So I wish I could give you more information, but
maybe we will have some for you soon.
Maybe someone will help us out there. Now, a cool thing, speaking of someone helping us out, Juliet from Paris, France, had some questions last week. And Mick in Carnforth is going to be able to answer at least some of those.
Are they were shrimpy questions?
Shrimpy questions, yeah.
Okay. So Mick says, with my Sakura Reds, it does tend to be the females that have the more intense colors. I generally thin out a percentage of young that are poor colors or wild sports. I also kept two female snowball shrimp that survived after my heating went out over Christmas, and they developed a saddle several times, but as there were no males, never buried up. So I agree with Russ that they need to mate every time to produce fertile eggs.
Okay, so there's one answer to Juliet's question about the Sakura Reds and their coloration relating to...
I was wondering if the colors of the Sakura Reds was a dimorphic characteristic.
Yeah, exactly. See, I like it when you say stuff like that.
Yeah, see, you think it's sexy when I use words like dimorphic and surface area.
Yeah, I do. It's cool. So, basically, there's that, and then there's this issue about the females. Now, when they develop a saddle, that's actually the eggs developing inside the female, and you can see it because their bodies are translucent.
But buried is when they're fertilized?
Buried is once they've been, fertilized and then laid. So
laid...
The female lays the eggs, but then burying up means basically that she they've left the inside of her body, and she's now holding them externally in her swimmerettes.
The little wiggly legs.
Yeah, underneath. The swimmerettes, they're called.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I can say dimorphic. I don't know if I can say spats yet.
Swimmerettes.
So, see, I can't. Okay.
And then he also had an idea about removing sand substrate for Anne.
Oh, what does he say about that?
Pittsburgh. He says, I also think that when removing sand substrate, siphoning out is the best method.
Okay.
You do tend to have to put most of the water back in the tank, though, as you always get a lot of water and not much sand. So I recycle the water back into the tank until I have the sand out, then draw the clean water out afterwards. Like that. Good idea. That's a good way to make it a more reasonable process.
There you go.
It's also a good idea to use a colander to save water blasting the sand all around when filling up the tank from scratch or when doing water changes. Colander. Good
idea.
So
what do you do with the colander?
You put the colander in when you're filling up the tank or when you're doing water changes. So when all the water pouring
in
from
the sand is already in the
hose.
Tank.
Yeah.
Oh,
it goes
okay,
into the colander, and then the water is dispersed in small streams.
Blasting a big hole in your substrate?
Yeah, like a spray bar kind of. Okay. Does it the surface of the water? This does it near the substrate level.
That's a good idea.
Another great idea. Thank you, Mick. And he also says...
He says, I couldn't get the bee shrimp I wanted, but I did pick up 10 orange cherries at my club meeting this week, which are looking nice. I will post a video on my YouTube site and let you know when it is up. I also got some nori sheets, which the shrimp seem to love, although it seems to take them a couple of days to clear it all.
Yeah, and a little goes a long way with those. But I'm glad the nori sheets are working out for you and for Juliet.
And we will look forward to seeing your new video.
Yeah, that sounds cool. It's funny that now, since they're red cherry shrimp, red cherry totally makes sense, but now we have all kinds of cherries. You know, we got orange cherries and blue cherries.
Do they have Rainier cherries?
What's that?
Rainier cherries, you know, in the grocery store. They're like kind of reddish pink on one side and kind of a peachy color on the other side. They're cherries. Oh. It's a joke.
Okay. No, I get it. Maybe. Okay, sorry. I'm a little slow, folks, tonight.
It's okay. You didn't think somebody was painting the fishy's toenails.
Well, that's okay. Well, now we need to say thank you to...
Andreka.
Carlos.
Jackson.
Ken.
Cliff.
Sam.
Tony.
Nathan.
And Mick.
Yeah. And may the fish...
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.